certification opportunity, and then our cattle handling demonstration that we'll have after a bit. I want to introduce the four coordinators. This was a group effort of South Dakota, which I'm Tracy Walsh, from the BQA coordinator in South Dakota, Libby Bigler, Colorado, Steve Paisley, Wyoming, and Rob Eirich out of Nebraska. And we just wanted to offer this as an opportunity for all of you to participate in the BQA program. Real quick, let's go down. You should have got an agenda outside the door. We're going to start in here. We're going to talk about the best management practices and then what you need to know about the vet feed directive. And then we're going to head over to the Ranchway building where the arena is. You can either walk, Libby will direct people there, or drive over there. That's where we're going to have our shoot side cattle demonstrations, and then we'll end the evening or the afternoon with stockmanship and stewardship demonstration with Kurt Pate. So out on the table, there's several handouts. There's a BQA bumper sticker, the cattle care and handling guidelines, the on-farm training producer manual. This is what most of the things we're going to talk about are coming out of. And then a couple posters if you're interested, caring for compromised cattle, and then injection site tip management. And then for your name tags, there's an I'm a BQA certified sticker that you can put on your name tags for the symposium. Does anybody have any questions? We did, before we get started, we did want to kind of see where everybody's from. So those that are from Colorado, do you want to raise your hand? We got a pretty good crowd from Colorado. How about Wyoming? Nebraska? South Dakota? We've got a few people. Any other? Kansas? Okay. Montana? Am I missing any other states that's here today? Where are you? Utah?
California.
California. Any countries that are here that aren't in the United States? Because I know sometimes the symposium gets people from other countries. So, well, welcome. And like I said, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm just going to do a little introduction about the BQA program, and then we're going to take turns and turn it over to the other ones. So the Beef Quality Assurance Program really is that from producer's gate to the consumer's plate. It is paid for in all of our states as well as nationally by the beef checkoff, so that $1 per head, and then extension as well in many states. Some of the two of us are, Steve and Rob are both extension employees. I'm Beef Council and then Colorado State employee. So the goal of the BQA program is to raise consumer confidence through offering proper management techniques and a commitment to quality within every segment of the beef industry. And we're going to give you a snapshot of that today. So what is BQA? It's our industry's voluntary quality control program. It's a set of 8 best management practices. Really looks at those day-to-day management practices that you do on your operations every day. And we just want you to know it's an educational tool. It's not regulatory. These are things to help us all improve, to help build consumer confidence. So when you think about beef quality, what do you think about? On either as you're raising cattle or when you're eating a steak somewhere. We always want to make sure we have the consumer in mind. We want safety, freedom from defects, tenderness, taste, eating experience, consistency, and predictability. So we really just want you to think about when you're in your operation to take a look at what could go wrong, and then figure out a plan to avoid those problems, really writing down those protocols on everything that you do on your operation. And make sure that not only yourself, but your employees and family are trained and educated, and that you have checklists and then your records. So every 4 or 5 years, the National BQA does a beef quality audit, and we just wanted, it might be kind of hard to see from the back, but we just wanted to give you an overview of where we've been from 1991 to 2011. So some of our shortcomings in 1991 included the external fat, seam fat, overall palatability, tenderness, overall cutability, and marketing, or marbling, excuse me. And then as we go across, in 2011, which was the last quality audit that was conducted, the issues were food safety, eating satisfaction, how and where cattle were raised, lean fat and bone, weight and size, cattle genetics. So just give you an idea of things that we've improved on and things that a lot of these have to do with what the consumer is asking for. Another quality audit will be done. This year it's the bull and cow audit, and then there'll be a national quality audit, just to really give us benchmarks on what we're doing well as an industry and what we can work on. And as part of that last quality audit, this is just some information to keep in mind. So a couple questions that were asked were about off-label drug use and then withdraw times. So when producers were asked, more than 25% of producers use medications other than directed on a drug product's label without being directed by a veterinarian. And then withdraw times, less than 47% actually use written records to determine withdraw dates. And you'll find as we go on today that those things are very important. We want you to work with your veterinarian, make sure that you're getting the dosage and whatnot from your veterinarian, and that you write down your withdraw times. And so it's really interesting to see where we are as an industry, and hopefully we continue to improve that. Ready?
Okay, we're going to switch out here. We're going to kind of start talking about a little bit about animal health and this probably a buzzword that we all hear, antibiotic stewardship, and kind of what that means as we move forward. But first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of go through here. This is actually the definition of stewardship as far as antimicrobials. It actually talks about the intervention designed to improve the measure of appropriate use of antimicrobials by promoting the selection of optimal antimicrobial drug regimes, dosage, duration of therapy, and route of administration. How many of you in here have been BQA certified before? Is that the things that we've been talking about since the 80s? So antibiotic stewardship is not a new thing. It's just a new term of what we've been doing on our operation for a long time. So we have to keep that in mind as we move forward. This idea behind stewardship and antibiotic resistance really comes into play as we look at what we do on our operations. Because our consumers want to know, and so hopefully we kind of go through this as we kind of continue on.
Back up here.
Okay. One of the things that we talk about when we think about antibiotic stewardship and what we think about in BQA is what do we do daily and how we make sure our consumers understand that. So where I start is I start here with developing protocols. You know, I ask this question all the time. How many of you have a written protocol for your vaccination program or your herd health program? Okay. How many of you know exactly what you do for your herd health program? Okay. I would say a majority of you can tell me exactly what your vaccination program is for your heifers, your cow herd, and your calves. Most of you can tell me that, but not very many of us write these protocols down. And so when I talk about developing protocols, I think it comes back to probably the main key point of this is to develop them, that way we have them written. Working with a veterinarian, all of us know the veterinary client-patient relationship is important in BQA. But that's probably the number one thing we have to continually do is work with a veterinarian to develop these protocols. And when you think about it, what are some of those core vaccines that we have to use? No matter what type of system we're in, whether it be organic, all natural, or just conventional production, all of these vaccination programs are key because, again, it's preventative measures, right? Because where do we get challenges for antibiotic resistance comes from? Usually it's from treatment, right? That's kind of the key thing that we think about. So we have kind of a core set of kind of a four-way, the respiratories, and then we look at our pastorella and our clostridials. those are kind of the basics that we continually develop with that veterinarian. Now, when we think about it, we can have multiple products that do the same thing, right? But how does it work in our system? Killed virus versus modified live? What is best for our operations? And I bet you each one of us has kind of a different management style that would change what we do there. And so without having that consultation of that veterinarian who has the newest products, but not only the newest products, but he has an idea of what your operation is and what will work best for you. So that's probably the key part. Again, there's a lot of other additional considerations depending, again, on management. But it should be written down on your protocols, whether you're going to implant, whether you have fly control, what kind of fly control you have. And this is going to be another piece that I didn't put up here, I haven't changed it yet, is looking at maybe alternatives of prevention or treatment. And Libby will get into more of the veterinary feed directive, but as we move forward, there might be some things in treatment protocols that might change for each and every one of you. I bet you every one of you in here could tell me what you give, what kind of treatment you give for foot rot, right off the top of your head. Draxin, LA, biomycin, those all kind of ring a bell, right? How many of you ever have that written down somewhere? What your treatment for different diagnoses is. Again, it's another challenge that we face. And we're all in the same boat. But we continually have to work on that development of those protocols. Because some of these things, that way we can use them judiciously and still be able to maintain them within our treatments. And so protocols, you probably, if you've been around me, you hear about them a lot. Because I'm a big person on protocols and making sure we have them written somewhere. It doesn't even have to be fancy. It can be on a computer. I bet you most of you in here probably are carrying your red book, your IRM book, or a treatment book, or a calving book in your pocket. I can remember, probably some of you know Ivan Rush. Every time I talk to him, the first thing he does, if I ask him a question, he has his red book in his pocket. Write it down in your red book, your treatments. There's a lot of other opportunities out there. Smartphones. Okay, some of you probably have a smartphone in your pocket. Okay, type it in there. Develop something where it's actually written. That way we have that documentation as we move forward and trying to keep educating our consumers on what we do and why we do it. So that's kind of some protocols and some treatments as well. When we start thinking about resistance, we really have to make sure that we're going back and understanding diagnosis is still so important. It depends on, you know, we have to make sure we have that routine observation, continually watching and observing those animals. Because if we can catch them early on in a diagnosis, it's a lot easier to treat those animals with the given products that are labeled for that diagnosis. If we start to think down through this, having that proper diagnosis and identifying what that treatment protocol is, again, we can kind of improve and we don't have so much concern with some of these things and resistance or as much of a risk for antibiotic resistance. So we continually work on that piece. Getting it early is still going to be the best. When we start thinking down through this, we'll talk more about this as we kind of get shoot side proper restraints, making sure we have that out there. Again, treatment, record your treatments and your IDs. And then the other thing that we continually see as we move forward is kind of go back and you have to observe those animals after that treatment. So you have kind of that follow-up. Because again, we want to make sure we're treating things and we get recovery instead of continually trying to retreat and retreat and retreat, because that's where our risk remains strong again for resistance. So we come back to that. Observation is the key. These pictures are kind of some of them are a little bit probably extreme. But when we start looking at these, as we see these animals, is this an animal that's probably going to recover very well? Should we treat this animal earlier on? Potentially. This calf looks like it probably has some respiratory. Its proper diagnosis was actually, that's a heat stress calf that came out of one of our university feed yards. Again, proper treatment protocols and proper diagnosis is always going to be pretty important for us. Okay? If you have anything, just catch me and start asking questions as well. As we kind of move into that treatment piece, is not everything is labeled for every diagnosis in the book, right? Okay, I'm going to throw something out here, and it probably goes back to the feed, but CTC for foot rot. Okay, it's not on the label. So reading labels is still important as well as we think about these treatment protocols and understanding where we find all this information. From the product name to the active ingredient dosage, withdrawal time, storage, expiration, and lot number. We're going to go through a couple labels here as I kind of move into the next couple slides to kind of show you these things. This is actually a bottle label, and we have a bottle of Draxxin if you want to take a look at that. It's empty, so it's not the $3,000 bottle of Draxxin that we're going to be sending around. And I know a few of you guys might try to pick up a syringe or something and gather a little up in your pocket, too. So, but it is an empty bottle. But when you look at those labels, this is actually the bottle label itself. You're always going to have the product name, and everybody knows that. Right underneath of it is the active ingredient. Why is the active ingredient important for us to know? Anybody? The broad, okay, the action. What's that?
Reaction.
Or the other thing is do we have products out there that are the same active ingredient? So if we didn't get results from one product and we change to another product with the same active ingredient, are we going to have the same results? Probably. And so keep that in mind, is making sure we understand those active ingredients as well. As you kind of look through the label, of course, it's going to tell you what it can be used for, okay, what animals, and usually that's right on the label. And then we start thinking about, okay, what's our dosage? Do we see dosage on this label anywhere? And I know it's hard to see. We don't have anything about dosage here. But usually you can tear this apart, okay, you can pull this whole string. And what's behind it? The full label, right? That's where you're going to start to see some of the dosage. And when you start thinking about that, that's where you have to look. Now, everybody always kind of says, well, I used it last time, I used 5 cc's per 100 weight. Is that right or is that wrong? Or was that that product or was it another product? Okay? That is always... and. We have a cow-calf operation at home. I come from a feedlot background. I'm not immune to this, okay? So we have to make sure we're finding those things, and I'll show you in the next slide another opportunity. But other things, we always have a withdrawal time. Here, we talk about not using it on dairy cattle. Do we have any dairymen in here? Okay. Dairy cattle that are actually 20 months or older. And then we go down through here, let's see, cattle, slaughter time, withdrawal time, 18 days. Remember to always read the label on withdrawal times. As those products change a little bit, those withdrawal times have a tendency of sometimes changing as well. So just because it was 18 days now, if something comes out new down the road, it might change a little bit. As we're talking about withdrawal times, do vaccinations have withdrawal times? Do vaccinations have withdrawal times? Yes. vaccines also have withdrawal times. A lot of them are 21, 24 days. We do have some that are 60 days, especially in the cow-calf side. Cow vaccines, some Vibro, some Liptos, are 60 days. So why is that important to know? Work cattle, slough a calf. What's the first thing you want to do with that calf? We want to ship her, right? If you've used the product within that 60, that has that 60-day withdrawal, now where are we at? Potential for drug residues. So again, read the labels. We have to continually read the labels. The other key part, and we'll talk more about it, is right down here, storage information. But we'll get into that in another slide. Okay, here's the actual box of that label as well. Most of that information is also here. But here, they actually have a dosage chart. So that dosage chart will help you. Some of the new syringes, and Dr. Paisley will show you those shoot side. Some of those, I think you have a Draxxin. You have a Draxxin syringe, and it actually has the dosage right there where you can click the dosage on the syringe itself. But that's only for the Draxxin, so you have to remember that. And we'll talk about that shoot side. But again, that information can be found on the box as well. But what usually happens to the box as soon as we pull the bottle out? Okay, it usually is in the back of the pickup and blows out, right? All right. So, but keep that in mind as we kind of look at. Same thing, I just got another label here by Amiacin. Again, oxytetracycline. What other products are Oxytet? LA is another Oxytet product. So again, just depends on what product you're using, making sure you understand those. One of the things that's another opportunity for labels, and I don't know how many of you use smartphones or iPads for records. One of the things that I found, the compendium of veterinary products, if you go into your vet or if you go into one of your animal health distributors, you'll probably see a big gold book that says Bayer on the front. That gold book is probably about 4 inches thick, very fine print, but it has every veterinary product that we use in the U.S. in there, okay? But this actually can be found online, that you can actually download the app to your smartphone or to your iPad, or you can actually get on a computer that's connected to the Internet with this website here, and it's under Bayer, and you can find it. But let me give you an example here, and this is an example that I pulled on my smartphone the other day, and then I'll show you it on my iPad. It comes up like this. I tap the screen. I put in bovine respiratory disease for treatment. What it did is it gave me all of the current products that are labeled to treat BRD. Once I get in there, I can click on one, and I just use Resflor Gold. Everybody's going, why use Resflor Gold when it's cold outside? But I just picked one. Again, it pulls up. The first thing it pulls up for me is the beginning of the label. It tells me it's subcutaneous for beef cattle. It tells me everything I can use it on. It gives me the description. But as I click on it again to the use and dosage, over here, it tells me it's a subcutaneous. It gives 2.2 milligrams. Let's see. Actually, I can't read it either. 6 milliliters or 6 per cc's per 100 weight. Okay, so you give that there, but then it also gives me my withdrawal time right there of 38 days. Because I found a lot of yards, feed yards I work with, as well as other operations. If you have a bottle that's been around and you've used it, well, that usually happens to the label. Kind of gets hard to read, doesn't it? And so this is another option that you can use, but you can also use this in a similar fashion to look at maybe putting together some protocols for your operation. of common diseases. I'll just pop out here real quick, show you what it kind of looks like. You can actually look things up by manufacturer, by what category it's in, what you're trying to use, the diagnosis, what you're going to use it for, the active ingredient. The biologicals, this is where all our vaccines are. And then there's a withdrawal chart in there as well. But once I click on that, I'll just put product usage, beef cattle right on the top. Everything is listed in alphabetical order of anything that you might have as a diagnosis. A to Z is up there. And usually if you have it on there and you update it regularly, it'll bring in the newest products as you move forward. It's a great tool to use. Feed yards like to use it as their shoot site sometimes to do withdrawal times and keep up with that scenario as well. Questions on this? If you're interested in this, I'm going to be around the rest of the week until Thursday. Catch up with me, and I'll kind of take you through that process if you'd like to learn more about that. We'll talk a little bit more about this shoot site as well. It's actually the equipment that we use. It's always key to keep things sterile, clean. When you're cleaning syringes, you shouldn't be using antibacterial soaps to clean these syringes. You want to make sure you're using hot water. Clean them with hot water, get them good and clean. Because, again, as you use that antibiotic soap, it's actually counteracting a lot of the vaccines that you put in it and a lot of the active ingredients. So if you kind of stay away from that, hot water, metal syringes are, this is a pretty old metal syringe. Now some of the plastic ones, the new ones, there's some ways that you can actually sterilize them with water, put them in a bag wrapped in paper cloth and microwave them for briefly to sterilize them. We actually, if you go to the Great Plains Veterinary Education Center, they actually have a video of that where they can do that. But hot water is still the easiest. Just good hot water. The other thing is as you think about sterile, clean syringes, how many of you have these nice disposable syringes? How much do you use it? How many times do you use it? Until it breaks. Okay? Perfect. I would say most people would say that, okay? But even keeping these clean. But the other thing is they're called disposable for what reason? Okay? They're cheap. You shouldn't use them until they are actually dead, okay? We need to use them what we can, but making sure we even clean those out. And even when we talk about needles, okay? This is a 5-cent needle. Calves today, well, I shouldn't say calves today. Calves last week. Steve's been telling me and keeping me updated today. Calves last week, a 5-cent needle versus a $1,500, $1,600 calf. You know, it makes a difference. Okay, or a cow with some of the new anaplasmosis type of issues that we're seeing. Dirty needles, blood-borne, going from one cow to another. A 5-cent needle is pretty cheap. So kind of keep that in mind. Steve, you're going to talk more about sizing and things over at the shoot side. But we actually have some charts available, and we'll talk more about what we can use size-wise as we get over to the shoot side. How often do you change needles? Every time? 10 times, 20 times, until we can't push it through the hide anymore, until they break, until they bend. Okay, this is actually a picture that our counterpart in Iowa put together. This is a brand new needle. As you go down, this has been used once, twice, three times, all the way over to 15 times. As you see the spots, as you see the pieces of particles inside that needle, it goes anywhere from blood, body fluid, to tissue. Here's hair. You can see tissue here. And see how it just keeps getting worse. You can see it get darker and darker. This is 15 times. I talked a little bit about anioplasmosis here in the last slide. In those cows that we have for 2 years or more, the risk gets higher and higher. But if you have it in one and you inject the next one, what is the potential risk of moving that forward to the next one? As you look at this slide. Again, we have some parameters that we talk about. We say every 10 to 15 hit. Should I ask how many people do this? But every 10 to 15 hit. What I say, best guideline I have is never put a used needle back into a bottle to refill. Never put a used needle back into a bottle to refill. So if you're giving a 5cc vaccine, it's every 10, right? And in a gun like this. If you're giving two, it's every 25. That is pretty much the guideline that I use. When we're treating calves, when we're doctoring shoot side, how often should we be changing needles? Every time. Again, it's a 5-cent needle. It's a 5-cent needle. And so when you kind of look at those things, this is actually a pretty good picture. And actually, we've done some Petri dishes of this before. Some people have. It's pretty amazing what you come up with. Even a needle that's been dropped on the ground and picked back up. You can get some pretty interesting colors and things in a Petri dish of infectious type of diseases coming out of it. So kind of keep that in mind. We'll talk more about this as well, shoot side, but just our guidelines. Of course, everybody knows different routes of administration. We want to make sure that we encourage you to use subcutaneous as much as possible. And I think there's some good news, and I actually shared it with these folks yesterday in some emails. Even things like Lugolix is changing. And we have some opportunities that's going sub-Q on the label as well. And a different kind of modified product. So when we think about that, if we can continually move to subcutaneous, we get needles out of muscle tissue. Every time we put a needle into a muscle tissue, we create scar tissue. Anytime we inject a needle intramuscular, we get scar tissue. We get injection sites. So again, we have to think about if we can continually work things subcutaneous, that's where we want to be. Even though some products are labeled for other routes of administration, we understand that. But when you have your choice, always go sub-Q. Neck locations, 10 cc's per injection site. I actually use that even on subcutaneous. And all injection sites should be at least 4 inches apart. And when possible, use a product that has low dosage versus a high dosage product. Pen G is a perfect example. That's a high dosage product. Duraxin is an example of a low dosage product. And you'll get more results, better results, with some of the newer low dosage products than you will some of the old high dosage products. So again, we'll keep that in mind and we'll see more of that as we move shoot side. This is probably a new slide for a lot of you, remote delivery systems. And does everybody know what I mean when I say remote delivery systems?
Darts
is one. Long-handled syringes, those type of things that are used. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying that we need to be aware of some things that have some concerns on the BQA side. One, the proper injection site. We still have to go toward the neck. We still have to be giving these injections to the neck. We spent 30 years to go from 25% of all carcasses with injection sites to less than 0.00001%. We've made drastic improvements, but we need to continually get things to the neck. The other thing is proper administration. making sure we're selecting the right needles for those darts that will give us a subcutaneous injection. The right length, and those darts, some of them have side delivery versus a point delivery system, so we have to think about those as well. Proper dosage, broken needles, or even the whole dart and muscle is a concern. And then I'm going to leave the last one until we kind of talk about the slide here. This is actually kind of a project we did. This is an animal that had been euthanized for another situation that was in a feed yard. And so at the Meat Animal Research Center at Clay Center, they have a dart gun. They put it in a vise. They had this animal where they could get a shot 20 yards away. They actually sighted in the gun for the top of the neck, which is right here. So this is the injection site of the neck. They figured, okay, they just pulled a product out of the air and said, pin. Pin is a 10cc injection per hundred weight. So they were figuring they need 60cc's. The dart gun they used, the largest dart they could get is a 10cc dart. So that would be 6 darts. Okay. 3 darts delivered the full dosage, which are those 3. This dart didn't deliver the complete dosage. That's only 4, right? They're up here. The other 2 actually flew off, and they were actually spewing the pin G as they came off of the animal itself. So that's one of those things. This is just an example. Again, there's some areas that this is a route that we have to use. There's no doubt about that. But we have to be very aware of the fact, are we doing it properly? Are we getting the proper dosage? Are we getting it in the right location? There's animal welfare issues here as well. You got large pastures, no place to get those animals in for restraint. Okay, that might be an issue. Instead of trying to run them, rope them, those type of things, this might be an area where we can use these things. But again, keep in mind to kind of sort through in your mind, making sure that we're still meeting our BQA guidelines. Okay. Again, I'll be happy to visit with you about that as well this week if you have any questions there. Transportation of these products, where we have them, how we store them is always kind of interesting, but we always have to read those labels to make sure we're storing products in the right temperatures. Even when we transport them, keep them in closed containers, keep them out of the sunlight and appropriate temperatures, coolers and those type of things. This is an example. This was last March on the dash of my pickup. Those 2 boxes are empty, so 38 degrees outside in March, which was a good day in March, okay? On the dash of my pickup was 95.9 degrees at noon. So a lot of these products, when you think about that, that's starting to get to the top end of their storage temperatures. Meat Animal Research Center did a study with putting temperature gauges that recorded in vet boxes as well. Vet boxes in the summertime under shade trees are reaching 100 degrees at points. So again, it brought to all of our attention, we need to be aware of storage and how we transport these products. The other thing on this slide is that we kind of go over as well is how often or how quick do we mix our products. And that's another key here, talking about handling. If we're going to work 200 head, should we mix all 200 doses? Or should we mix as we go? We should be mixing as we go. No more than 100, or 100, no more than an hour ahead of what we actually give the product. Okay, so kind of keep that in mind. The other thing, even refrigerators. I get big on refrigerators, okay? What is usually the refrigerator we store our animal health products in?
Kitchen refrigerator.
Okay, why is it in the barn? It didn't work in the house. Okay? Purchasing just a small thermometer to put in there just to keep track of what it is. Some of you, you know, it wasn't keeping our beverage in the house cold enough, so we moved it to the shop. Or it was keeping our beverage too cold, and so we moved it to the shop. Okay, it's always, that's usually what I see. It happens, again, I'm in your boots as well. It happens on our operation. But keeping track of that is always a challenge. Making sure we have that in the right storage temperature. Somebody told me that we should put the little blue mountains off of a beverage on our antibiotic boxes, and then we'd know. So I can say that down here. So. Record keeping. Making sure we're keeping appropriate records of our inventories, as well as our treatment and our processing. One of the things that is always the key is making sure as you give your antibiotics or your treatment protocols, making sure that you keep a record of your lot numbers, including your expiration dates. Lot numbers are a key. If you ever have any type of a challenge with a product, without that lot number, it makes it a lot more difficult to ever know if it is or not. And when you go to work with the manufacturers, the first thing they're going to ask you for is the lot number. And if you don't have that, it becomes a little more difficult. This is an example of what I've gone to, is, of course, I got a smartphone. So when we have the product, before we get started, I take a picture of the label, and then I take a picture of all the lot numbers and expiration dates. And I put them in a file. I do the same way. Here's our other vaccine products and our actual implants in the feed gun. Then I can keep those in a file. This was our weaning vaccine, our weaning protocols. Do it for our calf protocols as well. So then you have those. It's an easy way. Other people will tear, you can tear the box label off and staple it to your processing records. Any way that you can keep track of those is a key. Record keeping is always pretty important as we get into BQA. We recommend in Nebraska, we recommend 3 years. Is that what everybody? Okay, I didn't want to overstep my bounds, but recommend 3 years. Because sometimes when we think about our different management systems, some of those animals, it might be 3 years before that product actually hits the consumer's dinner plate. So 3 years is what we're saying on that side of things. If you ever need an animal treatment record systems or just sheets, we can work with you. All of us have access to the National BQA, or you can get online at bqa.org, and you can find these sheets. And most of us have websites, too, that you can get from there. I know my website has these record sheets on there as well for treatment, the whole thing. We did talk a little bit about protocols, and I know Tracy mentioned, you know, standard operating procedures. All of us have access to those as well through the website. So if you ever need those, probably more importantly on the feed yard side, but continually to be used as far as cow-calf as well. These are my resources, and you're always welcome to go to any of those sites for Nebraska. I know Wyoming, Colorado State, and SDSU also has websites, but those are some options that you have for my materials. Any quick questions? And we want to try to get you through BSDs here next with Libby, and then we'll get shoot set.
All right, so a really important topic of discussion that relates to BQA is this idea of the Veterinary Feed Directive. How many of you guys have heard of the Veterinary Feed Directive? Okay, how many of you have a pretty good understanding of what VFDs are? A handful of you? I want to go through today and kind of give you all an idea of really what the Veterinary Feed Directive is, why it came about, and really what that's going to mean to you guys as producers. So how many of you in here have actually do feed medicated feed? Mostly for treatment, right? We talked about a lot for treatment, sometimes for prevention. Okay, so of course we've had a lot more things about the Veterinary Feed Directive in the news, especially since October 1st of this year. That's when this new Veterinary Feed Directive rule actually came into place for the medicated feeds that are currently listed under VFD regulation. So you can see here, these are mostly in the popular press for the beef industry, some of the headlines from Drovers and things like that. Just trying to educate you all about what the Veterinary Feed Directive is, but sometimes that gets pretty bogged down in terms of what you need to read through. So what caused the Food and Drug Administration to come up with this idea for the Veterinary Feed Directive? Does anybody know? Nobody really knows, huh? Absolutely. So there has been a big issue for several years now with concern in kind of generating these superbugs that could be resistant in humans because of subtherapeutic feeding of antimicrobials, antibiotics, in livestock. So the FDA came up with this idea of a veterinary feed directive, which does allow for vital feed antibiotic use in livestock to protect their health and well-being. The only caveat is that we have to make sure that it's for prevention, control, and treatment of these bacterial diseases. And that's going to be what falls under the VFD. So what exactly is a veterinary feed directive? It's a written order, and it can be either paper or electronic, by a licensed veterinarian in the course of their practice approving the use of a VFD feed or VFD medication. So then that gets tricky there as well, right? What is a VFD medication? So that gets us into this discussion of what drugs are going to be affected under the VFD rule. So first and foremost, it's only going to affect antibiotics that are administered in the feeder water. So no injectables are going to be included. So you can still treat your livestock with any approved, FDA-approved injectable antibiotics. The ones that are in feed are going to require a VFD. The ones that are in water are going to require a prescription. Now, there's a difference between a VFD and a prescription. A VFD doesn't go through the state's pharmacy board, correct? So all it is having a little bit more regulation and a little more vet input on what you're doing. The antibiotics that are in the water can be used extra label with a veterinarian's consent. They are a prescription. However, if you are trying to do something extra label with antibiotics in feed, that's illegal. That has been illegal for probably about 20 years. So if you're doing something aside from what the label says right now on a feed, we talked about CTC for foot rot, that's illegal. So you can't use anything extra label, and that doesn't change under this VFD rule. So now once you get past that, we know it's not for injectables, only for antibiotics in feed or water. The next kind of step is that it only includes antibiotics that the FDA considers medically important in humans that we talked about earlier. So if it's considered medically important and is in the feed, it's going to require a veterinary feed directive. So things like ionophores, parasite control, insect control, those things are not considered medically important, so they don't require a veterinary feed directive. And then the final phase is all of these things that are currently over-the-counter that fit into these two categories are going to be veterinary feed directive. So essentially what's happening is the FDA is requiring the marketing status of these products to be changed from over-the-counter to VFD or prescription. That makes sense? So if you guys want some more specifics of what's going to be affected, here's a slide that I stole from Dr. Craig Lewis with the FDA. You can see on the top, I don't know if you guys can see in the back, but currently the only VFD-approved drugs today for cattle is tilmycosin. Over the next year and a month, we're going to add another five to that list, including neomycin, tylosin, virginiamycin, and then the tetracyclines, chlorotetracycline and oxytetracycline. So That might be something you might want to take a picture of. Your vets are going to know that anyways when you work with them. So the timeline for this, like I said, as of October 1st, the VFD rule went into place. And like I said, there's only one on there that currently is going to require a VFD as of today or tomorrow or next June. Okay, that's the Tilmycosin. When it comes to January 1st of 2017, those other five products and the rest that were on that bottom portion of that list for swine and poultry, those will then be veterinary feed directive drugs. So we've got another year and a month-ish to start consulting with our vet, start consulting with our feed mill, and kind of figure out a plan for what we're going to do with these VFD antibiotics. So what you guys are really probably wondering is what this means for you guys. Uh-oh. Okay, we're back. First of all, Rob talked about that veterinary client-patient relationship. That's extremely important. That's one of the BQA guidelines. So if you already have a really strong veterinary client-patient relationship, you're going to probably be in good shape. If you consult a vet for all of these decisions, you're going to be in good shape. The tricky part about this is that each state, and we've got, what, five or six states represented in here, they each define veterinary client-patient relationship differently. So this point here says that that state's agency that regulates veterinary licensure has their own idea of what a veterinary client-patient relationship is. Now, if it's not actually written down, the FDA has listed these four things that the vet needs to be responsible for in this relationship. So first of all, the vet needs to be familiar with the care and management cattle receive by the client and make preliminary diagnosis. They also need to be willing to assume responsibility, and the client needs to make sure they follow the veterinarian's instructions. The vet also needs to be willing to provide treatment and oversight. And then they also need to keep records on that herd. So maybe you guys have some consulting vet that you call up and you say, hey, I need such and such. Well, now we have to make sure that that vet knows your herd, that has some idea of your herd and is willing to take responsibility for what happens there. The next thing that you probably need to start thinking about, I mentioned earlier, is visit with your veterinarian and kind of come up with a plan with them ahead of time so that you don't need this VFD feed tomorrow and you call them up and say, hey, what do I do? Kind of have a schedule and know what you need, and then that way you can get in touch with that vet and understand kind of what requirements are needed and things like that. And then I also would suggest getting in touch with your feed distributor. I went to a meeting in Denver on the veterinary feed directive, and most of the feed distributors that were there were pretty savvy with this. So they're already ready to kind of implement. So if you talk with them, they're going to give you some really good insight on what's going on here with VFD and what they're going to require. So when it comes to putting this VFD together, your vet's going to have a lot of oversight. And the things that they're going to determine include the regimen of antibiotic, the dose and duration, which has to be within the label options, right? Because anything extra label is illegal right now, and it has been for 20 years. So sometimes there's only one thing that you can feed for, right? The vet's also going to determine the number of cattle which the VFD drug may be fed, the amount that may be purchased, as well as the duration of use and the expiration date. So the duration of use is the amount of time that you can actually feed that VFD feed, and then the expiration date is the final day that the VFD feed can be fed. So all of those things will come through the vet. That's why that veterinary client patient relationship is so important. So you're probably thinking about record keeping, right? Rob talked a lot about record keeping. Is this going to change records? What the vet needs to write you the VFD is some simple things that you probably already will provide, including your name, address, phone number. You're going to need to provide a location of cattle. That doesn't have to be a premise ID necessarily. It can even be like a GPS coordinate is my understanding. It just where your cattle are located, your physical address. You also need the approximate weight and the number of cattle that are going to be covered under the veterinary feed directive. When it comes to records, there are going to be three copies that are written. One's going to be the producer copy, one's going to be a vet copy, one's going to be the feed mill copy, right? And everybody is required to keep those for at least 2 years. Rob mentioned we keep records for 3 years, so that's probably the better way to do it. So do you keep it longer rather than shorter in case anybody needs to look that up? So with that in mind, I wanted to get a little more interactive here. I also stole this slide from a webinar that National Cattlemen's did that Dr. Mike Apley put together with K-State. So I've got a few situations here, and I want you guys to kind of weigh in on whether or not you think a VFD is going to be required on January 1st of 2017. So if you're feeding milk replacer with neomycin and oxytetracycline, is a VFD going to be required? Yes or no? Yes, because milk replacer is considered a feed. Neomycin and oxytetracycline are both medically important to humans, right? So how about chlorotetracycline in the feed for foot rot? We already talked about this. Does it need a feed directive? Is there anything, other stipulations? You're not supposed to be doing it at all. It's illegal. It's illegal extra-label drug use because you cannot feed anything, any medicated feed, beyond what it says on the label, right? So on the other hand, how about a mineral or feed with chlorotetracycline for anaplasmosis prevention? Yep, you do, and you need a VFD for that because chlorotetracycline is on that list, but chlorotetracycline is labeled for anaplasmosis prevention. Okay? Oops, gave you the answer, sorry. Tylosin for reduction of liver abscesses. Does it need a VFD? Yes, that's on that list of medically important antibiotics, and it is labeled for prevention of liver abscesses.
CTC is putting a lot of minerals. Is that going to be still legal?
It's going to require
a
veterinary feed directive.
Are we talking about a mineral box and a trace
minerals? Anything that would have CTC in it is going to require a VFD. As it's on that list. So it includes blocks, mineral,
BDBI.
I don't think that one will. Ionophores won't. That counts.
So with that, how about monensin as the only antibiotic in the ration? That's a no. Monensin's not medically important to humans. So you can still get that over the counter, don't need a veterinary feed directive. How about monensin fed concurrently with Tylosin at the same time? Do you need it? Yes. Because you need the VFD for Tylosin, you need that VFD written to authorize it being fed at the same time as monensin. So you, just because one doesn't require it doesn't mean that you can feed it together without requiring a VFD. Then the last one, chlorotetracycline or oxytetracycline in the feed for treatment of BRD, bovine respiratory disease. Do we need a VFD? Did I hear any? Yes, you're right. Chlorotetracycline, oxytetracycline, they're labeled for the use of bovine respiratory disease, and those two are considered medically important to humans. Okay, so hopefully that gives you a better idea of maybe some common situations where you might need to get those veterinary feed directives. If you have more questions about that, like I said, we really need to work on consulting the vet, and you can also talk to the feed mill as well. So our big takeaway messages, number one, veterinary client-patient relationship. If you don't already have one, you're planning to feed medicated feeds that would require a VFD, you really need to get a relationship with a veterinarian. And the four of us in our states would be more than willing to hook you up with a vet in your region. Okay? Secondly, we got to make sure that when we're feeding medicated feeds that we abide by the label. Like I said, many times, if you're feeding off-label with a medicated feed, you're already doing something that is against the law, and we just want to make sure that you read those labels, just like Rob had mentioned on injectables. So those are my big takeaway messages. That's kind of the overall idea of the Veterinary Feed Directive. Of course, any regulations are very complicated. There's lots of gray areas that we might run into. So if you do have some more questions for us, feel free to talk to any of the four of us here. I know most of us are going to be here all week. Do you have any questions right now? Fly control should be okay. Yeah, they're not considered medically important, so they should be fine. Any more questions? Yes?
Did you mention that slide that lists the chart?
Sure. This one? So I tried to make sure to highlight the ones that are going to affect cattle, but this shows all of them that will be affected in poultry and swine as well. So that's probably a good one you might want to take a picture of and keep those in mind. Is there anything else from you guys on veterinary feed directive or even for Rob or Tracy? Okay, with that, our next steps are we're going to be going out across campus to pretty much directly opposite of where we are now to the Ranchway building. We're going to do a shoot side BQA demonstration with Dr. Paisley. We're going to have two options of getting there. Either you can walk with me, I'll lead a group over, or you can drive. If you want to drive, take this road that you guys came in on, go out there and take a right, and it horseshoes all the way around over to some gates. We're going to be in a warm-up arena kind of in the middle of the Ranchway building. The other thing that I want to mention before you guys take off, there's some turquoise sheets on the end of each row. Those are our evaluations. We would love for you guys to fill out this evaluation. You can turn it in at the registration desk. If you turn it in, you'll be entered into a drawing to win a Western print or a bag of feed. And we'll draw for that tomorrow morning. And then the final thing that I want to make sure you know is that if you skip out now, you won't get to be BQA certified because we have a contract and a really brief quiz that we're going to take after the shoot side demonstration. Following that quiz, Kurt Pate is going to do the stockmanship and stewardship demonstration. So be sure to stay for that. We've got live cattle over there, and it's going to be. We also have cookies and water over there, so a little bit of refreshment to get you that way. So we will see you over there, and we're going to start pretty promptly at 2:25. One more thing before you guys go. We are really excited to have the national BQA coordinator, manager in the room. Chase DeCoit is in the back if you want to raise your hand, Chase. He works out of the NCBA offices in Denver, so we're really glad that he's here to support us as we work through this BQA certification. So with that, we will head over to the Ranchway building. We'll see you at about 2:25.